I'm 21 years old, just joined Gray Advertising, wanted to learn everything I possibly could as quickly as possible. And I became fascinated with the idea of ads having different effectiveness in different programs, specifically on television. And I was interested also in ads in magazines and other media that were important at the time, more important than they are today in some cases. And Gray Advertising entertained my desire to analyze masses of data. And what I was able to do, looking at multiple studies, was I realized that there was no agreement between these studies. A J. Walter Thompson study showed this, and a study done by the Television Advertising Bureau showed that. In some cases, a situation comedy appeared to be the best place to put an ad for a food and beverage product. In other cases, it seemed like dramas were better. It depended who did the research and exactly the way they did the research. Then I went to another agency, and I continued my journey and my studies of context effect. Here, they had 1,500 copy tests they had done, and they had saved all of the results. So I was able to do a much bigger study. And what I saw was there were definitely context effects, but they were much more complicated because there was an interaction between the ad content and the context content. The ad itself has a certain tonality to it, its own psychological descriptors. Funny versus not funny, heartwarming versus not heartwarming. Those are some simple ideas that people have attached to trying to understand how to code an ad or a context. But I knew intuitively that it was much more complicated than that. That, for example, television show context, scripted shows, they have characters, and the characters have personalities. They have character types and, you know, character things like they have honor or they don't, but they also have personality characteristics like they're chatty or they aren't, or they're conceited or they're not. And those things certainly have an effect on the psychology of the context. Some of that stuff in ads, you have people who are very confident in ads, people who lack confidence in ads. So I knew that it was much more complicated than a couple of simple coding classifiers. What I didn't know was, how do I get that list of tonalities that I want to use to code ads and to code programs so I can see, do they align? Because that was my hypothesis from the beginning. As soon as I saw that there was a covariance and interaction effect between the specific ad and the specific context, then I knew I had to approach this in a more scientific way, and it would probably cost me money. So some years went by before I got to the next phase of the game. What we did was we boiled the ocean, essentially. We saw that there were over a million words in the English language, and we needed to pick from those million words which words we were going to use to code ads and programs. And we needed a way of deciding how to pick those words. So the first thing we had to do was to decimate the list. It was much too big, million words. We had to get it down to something manageable. So we figured a good way to do that would be, we wrote up a one page of instructions saying, we're looking for psychological words. Our instruction sheet said, psychological includes human values, like hope and love and education and family and so on. And it includes personality and character traits, as I mentioned before. And it also includes human situations like love triangle. It also includes content descriptors like fast moving or film noir and so on. So we gave them these examples to get their minds going. And we hired 22 coders because there are 22 volumes in the Oxford Unabridged Dictionary. So we gave each coder 1,000 plus page volume, and they started to fill a spreadsheet with those words. So they came up with over 13,000 words. Then we saw that some of those words hadn't been used in hundreds of years, and some of the words were synonyms, where one synonym was used more often than the other one. So we cut it down, and we wound up with a little over 10,000 words. That was about as far as we could go using that method, and we still had too many words. So then we reached into our pockets, and we did a 10,000 national probability sample in the U.S. of adults 18+. And we used many different variations of the questionnaire so that all 10,000 words were covered. But each person only had to answer for 1,000 words to get $15 at the end of the game. And for each word, it was exactly the same process, and it got to go pretty fast. We showed them a 6-point semantic differential scale, which at one end of the scale said me, the other end of the scale said not me. and then nothing else was labeled. So they got the idea. And so the first word came up, let's say it was conceited. And the respondent said, no, I'm not conceited. So they put it, they checked on the bottom box. And then another word came up, kindness. And they said, oh, I'm pretty kind. So they get put it on the second highest box close to me. And so on. And they went through this process. Then we did a factor analysis, which reduced all of the words based on their correlations with each other. It's obviously a very large correlation matrix. And we came up with clusters, 1,562 clusters. And each cluster had the words that it contained, and the words each had a correlation with the cluster. Now, by the rules of the game, you're allowed to take the word within the cluster that has the highest loading or correlation on the cluster as a proxy for the cluster. So we didn't invent that technique, we just used it. So that gave us a list of 1,562 words. And then we were somewhat bollocksed after that. What do we do with the 1,562 words? The answer was to come shortly thereafter, when I had a company called Next Century Media, which won an Emmy in the 90s for measuring the TV audience en masse, and also was able to deliver addressable commercials and program recommendations. And the program recommendations was the way we decided we were going to further winnow down the list. So we took all the shows on television. Back at the time, it was only about 10,000 shows reported by Nielsen. So we coded those 10,000 shows, again, human coders, by the 1,562 words. That took a long time. But when we got that done, now we had hundreds of thousands of homes with millions of people in them that had our software, which had been downloaded by the world's largest cable operator. So we had all these homes that had suddenly gotten 500 channels. This was the beginning of the digital set-top box era. So they had the first analog hybrid digital set-top boxes, digital analog, and they were able to expand their channel choice from 70 to 500. So I said, these people are not going to know what to watch on television. There's too much choice, but we can help them. And all they have to do is press the A button on the remote, and within a second, the system will function as an artificial intelligence and give them a recommended show to watch next. So a letter went out to all the subscribers that had these new boxes. They were told, if you don't know what to watch, give the AI a chance. It will not recommend anything you've ever watched before because we're keeping track of what you watch. We already told you that, and you already didn't opt out of that, which we gave you the right to, but nobody really did. So in 1997, we did this test, and what we found was I had built this optimization engine, which today would be classified as machine learning, but I just called it an optimizer then. And what it did was, let's say here's a household that just pressed the A button. They want to know what to watch next. So the system, within microseconds, looks at all the shows that have ever been watched by that set-top box. And all of the codes of the 1,562 codes that have been placed on that set-top box to characterize the kinds of shows it leaned towards, the system inferred what the weights should be because what it was trying to do was explain the conversions. Now, the conversions were the successful recommendations that resulted in people not only going to look at the show that was recommended, but actually watching 3 out of 4 of the next 4 episodes after the recommendation was made, which we called the conversion. So it looked at the conversions, and it looked at which of the 1,562 words appeared to be correlated, associated with the conversion events, and which of the 1,562 words almost never showed up in those cases that converted. It then started to vary the weights on the words. Words that showed up a lot during conversion events got higher and higher weights. Words that showed up very scarcely, if at all, during conversion events were deweighted eventually to 0. So as that was going on, we noted that the conversion rate was going up. It started at 3%. And it went up and up and up, and eventually it hit 18%, 6 times higher than where it started. And I noted that at that point, it had taken offline all but 265 of the words. We'll have to give them a name. And I said, how about behavior-driving meta tags? And everyone said, that's terrible. How about driver tags? And I said, okay, driver tags. We'll call them driver tags. That's what they've been called ever since. Now, ever since, we had clients very interested in this, particularly the studios and television networks. They wanted to see how they could make programs better. In addition, there were people in the advertising side of the business who thought we could use this to match ads. When we place ads in programs, we can do it not by blind random assignment, but by maximizing the alignment between the ad and the context. I think that, you know, one of the things that makes it obvious to me that it should work is that why do people sometimes vote with their wallet to buy pay TV that doesn't have commercials at all? It's because the mood of the program gets broken. There's a cognitive dissonance when the mood gets broken, which means that if you set things up so the mood isn't broken, so that the program mood flows into the ads, then you should see a more positive advertising effect. So we did the first study of that. And that study showed that there was higher alignment between the 265 driver tags in the specific ad and in the program the ad was placed in. The increase in sales effect was 36% on average. Now that's higher than what we're seeing now. A lot of at least 24 companies doing attention measurement now, and they tend to show that more attention leads to more advertising effectiveness, measuring it sometimes based on, did it cause a click-through? Did it cause a visit to the website? Did it cause a search for the brand? Did it cause higher brand recall? Did it cause higher ability to guess who was the brand that was advertised in that ad? In some cases, sales effects are measured in these attention studies. It's kind of rare. Not many are actually measuring sales effects. But here we had Nielsen Catalina measuring sales effects. And the sales effects of 36% on average is much higher than the increase in ad recall and stuff in most of the attention studies. Then there was a study that was done for one of the largest CPG brands in the world. They don't want their name used, but they allow us to use the results. And the big CPG advertiser said, look, I don't want to do the same study that Nielsen Catalina did. It's going to come the same answer. I don't want that. Let's do something more interesting. Let's do something like a Millward Brown type questionnaire where we measure all the funnel levels by a survey questionnaire. So they wound up doing, in addition to the set-top box data, they did 23,000 completed interviews. For a custom study, as you know, that's ginormous. So they did that study. And what it showed, interestingly enough, for purchase intent, it almost got the same number as Nielsen Catalina, but 37% increase in purchase intent in the cases where the alignment was, we call it resonance, was above average, compared to the 36% that Nielsen found for actual purchase. But they also measured a lot of other things, like first brand mention, also known as the saliency measure. In other words, I ask you, when you think of a bottled water, what brands come to mind? And if your brand, the client brand, is mentioned first, that counts as saliency. So that increased 62%. But the thing that thrilled the CMO of the CPG client the most, because it was such a big survey sample, you could break it out by frequency levels. And then in the low frequency tertile, the average frequency was 7. They only got 7 impressions. At least one of the 7 or whatever the number was of impressions went over 30% resonance. And then we looked and we saw that almost none of those people had 2 exposures over 30%. Over 90% of them, it was just 1 exposure. So the CMO was flabbergasted. What it said to him was that if you put an ad in the ideal environment, you don't need as much frequency, which could save a fortune of money. So that was another finding. The studies didn't end there. Something happened called digital, and digital, particularly since around 2017, has been, as you know, racing ahead of television and all other media types. Other media types are somewhat shrinking or holding their own in the case of television, but not growing. And all the growth ad spend has been going into digital. So we needed to have a horse in the race for digital. What are we going to do with driver tags for digital? Then we found a company called Somasio. Somasio, which is now operating in 26 countries, started in Europe. What it does is it takes a full text grab of all of the words on a page being visited by an ID. So there's all kinds of IDs out there. Somasio uses all of them, so it can interoperate with Trade Desk, Google, Facebook, whoever it is. And so what they're doing is they're tracking these IDs and they're seeing what URLs they're landing on. And then they're taking a picture of those URLs, and then they're compounding that across all the URLs visited by the ID. So if my ID goes to some sites that have to do with human consciousness, some sites that have to do with politics, some sites that have to do with other forms of media research, some sites that are humorous and so on and so forth, all of the tags that are already on, all of the words that are used in the text on those pages is being boiled down into like a tag cloud around my ID by Samasio. And that's what they do for a living. We made a deal with them and we trained their AI to reproduce a version of our driver tags. And when I say a version, we'd already by that point in time been asked by our clients, can't you condense the 265 driver tags? For two reasons. One is it's breaking our brain. And the other reason is you won't share those driver tags with us, but can't you condense them? Can you cluster them in somewhere into a small? So we worked hard on that. We went back to the clients and said, okay, here are 86 need states. And they said, thank you, but it's still too big. Do it one more time. Bring it down by another order of magnitude. So we did that and we brought it down to 15, what we call motivational types. So when we made our deal with Samasio, we thought in order to make this a lighter lift to get started, let's just start with the 15 motivational types. Then a national retail chain found out about this and said, we'd like to use this. We'd like to test it out, see how well it works for us. But we want to have you tell us what are the motivations in this ad that we're giving you. And then we want you to reach people who have those motivations according to the Samasio RMT method of looking at what content they consume. That's what we want. We want the resonance between the ad and the person, not between the ad and the context. And they said, later, we'll do both. Obviously, if you put both together, it's going to be even more powerful. But we want to start just with the person. So the same creative was given to a very well-known supplier of IDs of lookalikes. So the lookalikes that were being used by this retail chain and which were doing a decent job, that was the control group and we were the test group. And Neustar compared us to this other supplier that was using lookalikes. And Neustar said the increase in overall sales ROI, offline and online combined, of the driver tags over the affinity IDs was 95%. You almost doubled this extremely popular supplier of lookalike models. For new to brand, it was even 20% higher than that. So the most recent study worth mentioning was done by the Advertising Research Foundation's own Cognition Council. And it was a study of sales, IRI sales, for 19 different brands over a six-year period. What they had us do was to code the ads that were used over that six-year period by each of those 19 ads. And by the months that those ads were running, according to Kantar, and then they, ARF, Cognition Council, did their own analysis of that. And what they found was that 48% of the sales results were explained by the motivations. And when you break down the results to see which of the predictors, which of the motivational types had the highest prediction, it was wealth success, in other words, becoming wealthy as a motivation, status prestige, and then altruism was actually the third highest predictor under those two more selfish predictors. So what it says is that in the modern age with millennials and Gen Z and Gen Alpha, who tend to be more idealistic than the general population, but even millennials showed a greater degree of altruism than the baby boomers did. This altruism thing is not a flash in the pan. This is up there, very, very close to the impact of the selfish motivations of use my deodorant, you'll become rich and famous, you know, which are the implications of most ads, that your life will be better if you use my brand and it'll be better in all kinds of ways. So those are the validations. So that's one area. A second area that we're working in right now is specific to Canada. In Canada, we have a partner called Vividata, who corresponds to Target Group Index in Europe and other in Australia and other countries, and to MRI and Simmons in the US. So in Canada, we have a number of the largest Vividata subscribers in Canada are practically everyone in the advertising business in Canada, buy side, sell side, industry associations, everybody. And some of their largest agency and network clients are looking very closely at these data, which we're using the motivations initially in a self-serve system where people can set up their own tabulation, how they want to look at it, for any of the motivations. In Canada, they're not called motivations. They gave it the name drivers, vivid data drivers. So the drivers are the 15 motivations. And the way people in Canada, in confectionery and automotive and other categories are looking at using the data is to say, what are the motivations of the people who buy my brand? What are the motivations of the people who buy my competitor's brand? And maybe I should start to use some of the motivations that are in my competitor's brand if I'm trying to take away any business from them. So they're redoing the way they do their creative briefs to include the vivid data drivers as an input, a major input to the creative briefs. And that's just starting. That's a whole new market for us. And a third market, we've gotten a lot of many, many offers, including from IBM Watson and many other well-known AI companies. Practically all of the big well-known AI companies have wanted to talk to us about how can we add greater sensitivity to human feelings to their GPT-4 or whatever it might be. Because right now, there's no attempt to model human feelings. It's all about using language to, it's essentially like autofill. When you crowdsource all of the sentences in the internet or some subset of them, when a sentence starts out with these three words, what's the most likely fourth word, next best word? So that doesn't get into the domain of feelings at all. And you might accidentally use a word that might offend somebody. So that's their question. And so we're working with one AI company, not counting Somasio. We're working with one other, specifically AI company, that's, you know, totally not doing market research at all. It's just an AI company. And we expect to be doing more work with AI companies in general. That's a whole third area that we're excited about. And then the fourth area that's presenting itself very recently, and it's as a result of this attention craze that's, you know, sweeping, has swept the marketing industry, that after all these years in my hoping that we get to very sophisticated ways of coding contexts and coding ads so as to maximize advertising effectiveness, instead of getting the whole sauce at once, it's coming at us just one step at a time. Attention, the very first step of the process, is where we're focusing all of our attention on attention, not the fact that we also have to maintain that interest, get it to be positive emotion, brand attraction, long-term memory encoding, ultimately sales, behavior change. We're just focusing on the attention part. And in some cases, we're trying to correlate it with recall or sales effect. But we're still not looking at these other bio and neuro effects. We're getting people to ask us, could you combine the driver tags method with the attention method? Like, we're using attention method X, or no, we're using attention method Y. Can you combine your stuff with that? Yes, is the answer. And where this seems to be leading is it's time for addressable TV. And if you're going to go addressable, you might as well go programmatic, because that's what the agencies want. They want programmatic. It's the most efficient way. It increases their margins and it reduces their number of people that they need to support and so on and so forth. And if you do that, you might as well use an optimizer. And you might as well optimize on everything you can optimize on. And that's the way we're going to be carried along on the foottails of that movement.
Talk to me about addressability a little bit. What is addressable TV?
Well, it's the thing we were inventing with Next Century Media back in the 90s when we did the driver tag work that I described. Addressable means that you can send an ad to a specified list of people or households rather than broadcasting it. So I'm credited with inventing addressable. And now addressable is just starting to get off the ground in a big way, mostly because of streaming, because streaming is inherently addressable. And there are other addressable forms in television. We're going to be part of that, I think. And that'll be a fourth use case or revenue stream. We've done it for social media. We've done it, you know, for social posts that have logos in them that were started by a brand, but now people are responding to. We've done that for some agencies. Influencers. It can go, you know, to print magazines. It can go to video games. There's somebody in B2B who's investigating it right now. And we've had this conversation about rational versus emotional. And obviously, they're more skewed to rational appeals rather than emotional appeals. So I explained to them that if you were to try to use like facial emotional cues, don't expect necessarily to see a big smile on someone's face because your ball bearings have a higher tensile strength than somebody else's ball bearings. But in the frontal lobes of the brain, you would expect to see the brand attraction or repulsion effect. So you could call that emotive. Some people do call it affect or emotive. You know, these are just words.